Okay, great. Great. Thank you so much, Tracy, for your time and this interview today. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So to begin, just for our records, can I have you slowly say and spell your first and last name?
My first name is Torey, Torey. My last name is Dolan, Dolan.
Great. And can I have your title in this role for us today?
I'm an assistant professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School.
Great. And lastly, if any, can I have your tribal affiliation?
I'm a citizen of the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma.
Okay, great. And your location today?
I'm currently in my office in Madison, Wisconsin, at the University of Wisconsin Law School.
Okay, thank you. So this is really a big story here in Wisconsin that people across the state, especially in northern Wisconsin and Northwoods, are talking about. But to begin, kind of in the broad sense, when people hear that Lac du Flambeau is a sovereign nation, what does that mean?
The United States Constitution recognizes that Congress has the ability to regulate its relationship with Indian tribes. And in recognizing that, they recognize Indian tribes as sovereign, meaning that they have the ability to govern themselves and their territory that predates the United States. And so when we talk about Lac du Flambeau being sovereign, what we mean is that they have the ability to set their own laws and be governed by them, both their membership and their lands.
Okay. And so when we talk about they can govern themselves, what does that mean for the communities that are around them?
Lac du Flambeau's reservation is checkerboarded, meaning that there is a predominant non-Indian community in the area. And so often what that means is that non-Indian neighbors are intersecting with tribal law in interesting ways. The tribe retains the inherent sovereignty, meaning that it's always existed within them, to regulate civil jurisdiction in their area on certain matters. It gets very fact-specific and complicated depending on what the tribe is attempting to regulate, how the tribe is attempting to regulate when it comes to non-Indians or non-Indian land. But generally, just being in tribal territory, you are going to interact with tribal law in some capacity.
So when that happens, when the tribe says they're exercising their sovereignty or exercising their rights, is that what that means?
Yeah, it means that they're exercising their ability to have a say over what happens in their territory and in their community.
Okay. So when we say their territory, can you explain what does ceded territory mean here in Wisconsin?
Yes. So ceded territory usually refers to lands that were subject to a treaty, meaning that the tribe gives up certain rights over certain lands that they had prior to Europeans arriving on the continent. And in exchange, they secure a set of rights in a treaty. Many of those rights they already had. Some rights are going to be newly recognized from the United States, such as payment for ceded lands or protection from, other Europeans or protection from non-Indian communities. And so here in Wisconsin, there are a number of ceded lands from Ojibwe, Menominee, and other folks. I would say the only lands in Wisconsin that are not ceded from the local tribe would be the Oneida, because the Oneida are originally from New York and were forcibly removed to Wisconsin.
So it's there are 12 tribes in Wisconsin, and we know that we have 11 that are federally recognized, but each one has a different story, it sounds like.
Yes, each has a different story, subject to different treaties. And each tribe has different relationships with each other because many tribes were part of confederacies or political alliances or come from the same group. So there are a number of Ojibwe tribes in Wisconsin, for example.
And when we say territories, does that also include waters?
Yes.
Okay. And in regards to lac du flambeau, we're looking at three cases. And speaking of waters, let's dive into the case of the fishing and the walleye fish and Muskalungi, which has had a long history with tribal members and community members in Wisconsin. And oftentimes in the past, it was con very contentious and dangerous. Where we are now with this case is that they have said that due to environmental factors and other factors, they don't want non-tribal people fishing on 19 of their lakes, but they have 260 lakes. So they said for these 19 lakes, due to various reasons, we don't want non-tribal members to fish on 19 of these lakes, and we're putting an injunction on it. We're saying that you can't fish here, and it now has ended up in federal court. So as a sovereign nation, how do these cases end up in federal court?
So usually these cases dealing with hunting and fishing regulation, especially as they're related to the environment, end up in federal court, often because non-Indians are challenging the tribe's ability to regulate them in this way. I'll note that navigable waters are subject to a distinct legal standard within the United States, and it's different from regulating land, and it's different from regulating tribal land. Now, here in this instance, the tribe is very concerned about the walleye and the muskie population, and the Supreme Court has recognized that Indian tribes retain the inherent sovereignty to regulate non-members in certain instances when the behavior of non-members is going to affect the health, safety, economic security, or welfare of the tribe. And so, from the tribe's perspective here, walleye and muskie are very important to the tribe's subsistence, to the tribe's culture. And so, from their perspective, protecting the population in these 19 lakes necessitates them regulating non-Indians in this way. Now, on the other side, folks argue that, the tribe doesn't retain the ability to regulate non-members, and that's not a part of the right that's guaranteed in the treaty. But I will note that treaties don't contain the entirety of a tribe's sovereignty. They're just explicit reservation of rights secured at that time, but that doesn't mean it's the maximum of tribal power.
So, are there limits within treaty rights in terms of their rights and then who they can govern?
Yes. So, I will note that the tribes here have very strong hunting and fishing rights for themselves. Regulating other people is a different matter. So, in the past, the federal court has recognized that tribes here do not have jurisdiction over navigable waters and do not have the ability to regulate non-Indians pursuant to those treaties. There are other instances in the country where courts have recognized tribal power over navigable waters pursuant to treaties, and in part because there was a distinct property regime laid out in those treaties. But here in this instance, as I see it, it seems to me that the tribe is trying to exercise a degree of inherent sovereignty that might be distinct from the treaty itself.
So it's almost like a new element to their treaty or an addendum to their treaty.
It's a degree of sovereignty that exists outside the treaty. So imagine that, before colonists come to the United States, the tribe has a whole pizza pie, right? And the treaty is one slice of the pie that they decided to give away. The tribe has the remaining pieces, and so inherent sovereignty might be a part of that, those remaining pieces.
Okay, thank you for explaining that. Again, in regards to lac du flambeau, beyond rivers and waters in territory, property owners there are suing lac du flambeau, Lake Superior of Chippewa, for allegedly restricting their access to a boat launch that's on private property, but also on the reservation. So,
Yes.
first, why are there so many non-tribal members owning property on the lac du flambeau reservation?
Yeah, so in the 19th century, Congress implemented this policy called allotment. And the idea was that where tribes owned things in common, meaning all members and the tribe itself owns the property, they decided to break up that communal title and parcel out individual parcels of land to different families and then sell the surplus. The process of selling the surplus land within the reservation is what led to these checkerboarded reservations that we see today, where there are significant populations of non-Indians that own fee land within the exterior reservation boundaries. So the non-tribal members that own fee land within Lac des Flambeaux, one has attempted to build a boat launch to one of these restricted lakes from the private property. And this is the dispute at issue. Now, from the homeowner's perspective, you know, they view it as I'm not a member, I'm not subject to this tribe's jurisdiction, and this is my land that I own in fee, meaning under state title. But from the tribe's perspective, that goes back to the inherent sovereignty element that I mentioned, where the court has recognized that there are some instances where tribes do have the ability to regulate non-member conduct on fee land within the exterior reservation as part of their inherent sovereignty. And so that's the dispute. Is this environmental situation one that justifies the tribe having civil authority over fee land within the reservation?
Thank you for explaining that. So the association went to tribal court and lost, and the tribe won, and then they elevated it to federal court. How can that happen? How come it's not ended at the tribal court made a decision and that's that?
The reason that things don't end at tribal court is because it's a contest of jurisdiction, which tribal jurisdiction over non-members has been deemed to be a question of federal law. But there is a doctrine called the tribal court exhaustion doctrine, meaning that before you can go to federal court and challenge the tribe's ability to exercise authority over you, you have to exhaust all of the available remedies within the tribal government. So once a plaintiff has done that, then they can enter into federal court to challenge the tribe's exercise of jurisdiction at all.
So it seems like there's a lot of steps that happen before it can reach federal court.
Yes.
Okay. And going back to the Dawes Act, when did it end? And is it still playing a role in Lac des Flambeaux?
It's certainly still playing a role in Lac des Flambeaux because many of those parcels that were, removed from tribal ownership, they're now the parcels of land that are subject to dispute, or access to those parcels of land is what's subject to dispute in the road cases. Mm-hmm. And so it continues to impact the tribe's ability to govern today, because I'm sure people can imagine, you know, when you're trying to regulate the environment of an entire reservation, but you have parcel A and parcel B and parcel C that you have to prove your authority over, well, then it gets really hard to protect the entire environment because you have to prove your case for all of these broken up parcels within your territory.
And who broke up those parcels?
Congress.
Congress did that through the Dawes Act.
Yes.
And created that checkerboard that we're speaking about.
Yes. So the Congress created the Dawes Act, which authorized Indian agents to go into tribal communities, parcel out the communal land, sell the surplus. And so it's that process that has created the checkerboard pattern today. Part of the Dawes Act was motivated by this belief that the tribes would disappear, that eventually tribal people would die out or assimilate and be indistinguishable from non-Indian populations. And so because of that, that's why we have so many legal and political issues today, because they really didn't expect tribes and tribal people to endure.
And they didn't disappear.
We did not.
Right. They didn't disappear and still asserting their tribal sovereignty.
Yes.
So in the case of the four roads, those roads were essentially chopped up and checkerboard during the Dawes Act. Is that why they lost that case?
Well, so the roads themselves are on tribal land, but these are the roads that access these private parcels. Because when Congress chopped up, these reservations and these parcels of land, it was before cars and before the massive roadway infrastructure that we have. So after, these parcels were divided up in the 1950s, I believe, the Bureau of Indian Affairs agreed to some easements over these tribal lands, and that's how these roads were made. Now, the reason that the Bureau of Indian Affairs had the authority to do that is because legally within the United States, the federal government holds the title to tribal land for the benefit of Indian tribes. So there's been a long history of the United States exercising that legal authority to make decisions without consulting the tribe. Now, the Bureau of Indian Affairs approved these leases or these easements for these roads, but they were temporary and they expired. And so once they expired, the tribe wanted to engage in negotiation with the village and the township to renew these easements, but the tribe wanted payment and the tribe did not want to authorize permanent easements. Because once you authorize a permanent easement, that means that you give away that property right forever. And so because these private parcels of land that arose during the Dawes Act, people bought them and they needed a way to get to them. The Bureau of Indian Affairs approved these easements. And once they expired, the tribe sought to assert their property rights by closing these roads. And that's what led to that lawsuit.
Why is it important for Lac du Flambeau to get their laws enforced?
It's important for Lac du Flambeau to get their laws enforced because there's nowhere else in the world where Lac du Flambeau sovereignty is governing, right? This land, this territory is very important to them. For folks who have been to the area, the tribe is very present in the community. The lakes there, hold their clan stories, their religion. And so their ability to enforce their own laws means their ability to continue to exist as a people, to continue to exist in their territory, and to protect the area to ensure that 7 generations from now, Lac du Flambeau people can continue to exist there. And so every time that sovereignty is chipped away in a tribe's territory, it's really devastating because tribal sovereignty exists in our communities and not outside them. So we have to protect every bit of sovereignty we can.
And they keep fighting it, in such a short time we're seeing these cases. What does that say about the tribe? And also, does that cost money to keep having to go to court?
It costs a massive amount of money. And, Lac du Flambeau is in this situation where they have these three different cases, three different issues. So that gets very, very expensive because these are all distinct cases with distinct legal issues that take their own time and research. And, it's very hard on tribal leadership when these moments come up because, essentially, tribal leadership has to decide, do we fight this? Do we spend that money? Which often means taking money from community services, from health centers, from schools, from other vital services. Do we sacrifice those things to protect sovereignty in the long run? And those are really difficult political decisions. I really don't envy any tribal leader that's in that situation. But I think from what I've seen from statements from tribal leadership and from the way the tribe has asserted its rights, they recognize that these are existential fights about the future and the continued existence of the tribe, and they're going to fight them.
And as we finish up, these are three distinct cases recently with them. There's frustration for tribal members. There's also frustration for non-tribal members. And I was at one hearing, and the judge was said consistently that he wants the tribe to work on their state-to-state relationship as a tribe with the state of Wisconsin. What do you think is going to happen moving forward?
It's hard to predict what's going to happen. And I will say, this exists in the context of decades and decades and decades of conflict, especially when it comes to fishing. So, history runs deep in the North Woods for sure. But my hope is that, especially as we're dealing with more and more consequences of climate change, I hope folks in the North Woods, tribal members and non-tribal members will view tribal sovereignty as an asset. It's an additional layer of protection that can be exercised to protect the environment, to protect the community, to protect the walleye, to protect the musky fish. And while, these things are hard in the immediate moment, I hope that folks can come together on all sides of the issue, DNR, Lac-des-Flambeaux, the fish hatcheries, the recreational fishers, the tribal members. I hope they can all come together and, find commonality in the fact that everybody up there loves the land. The North Woods are beautiful, and I think everybody wants to protect the North Woods.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Tori. I think we'll end on that note. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So I think we are good. We have everything. I was wondering if you have, do you have any published books or anything with your name on the cover that you could send pictures to us if I needed some B-roll footage?
Yeah, I don't have books. I have law review articles, and then I have some. I filed a couple Supreme Court briefs. I have one that has my name on the front that's printed. Oh wait, actually, I do have printouts. Yes, I can send you that.
Yep, so send them to me. If and
Yes.
also if you or if you had any photos of you teaching in the classroom, pointing at a whiteboard or a wall, just for any background footage I can play around since you weren't able to come to the office today.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so email those to me when you can. And this is due to air this week, but if not, then it'll be the following week. So I'll keep you posted.
Okay, sounds great.
All right. Thank you, Tori. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.